They were in some kind of shock. I couldn't argue with them, so I tried to put them to work instead. We walked up the driveway, slow and quiet. The wind tore at our clothes. I was limping because of my shoe. I stopped where the bloodstains started and retrieved the email device. It was broken. The plastic screen was cracked, and it wouldn't turn on. I dropped it in my pocket. Then I found the heel rubber and sat cross-legged on the ground and put it back in place. Walking was easier after that. We reached the gate and unchained it and opened it, and I got my jacket and my coat back and put them on. I buttoned the coat and turned the collar up. Then I drove the Cadillac in through the gate and parked it near the gatehouse door. Richard chained the gate again. I went inside and opened the big Russian machine gun's breech and freed the ammunition belt. Then I lifted the gun off its chain, carried it outside into the wind, and put it sideways across the Cadillac's rear seat. I went back in and rolled the belt back into its box and took the chain off its ceiling hook and unscrewed the hook from the joist, carried the box and the chain and the hook outside and put them in the Cadillac's trunk.
"Can I help with anything?"
Elizabeth asked. "There are 20 more ammunition boxes," I said. "I want them all."
"I'm not going in there. Never again."
"Then I guess you can't help with anything." I carried 2 boxes at a time, so it took me 10 trips. I was still cold, and I was aching all over. I could still taste blood in my mouth. I stacked the boxes in the trunk and all over the floor in back and in the front passenger footwell. Then I slid into the driver's seat and tilted the mirror. My lips were split, and my gums were rimed with blood. My front teeth at the top were loose. I was upset about that. They had always been misaligned, and they had been a little chipped for years. But I got them when I was 8, and I was used to them, and they were the only ones I had.
"Are you okay?"
Elizabeth asked. I felt the back of my head. There was a tender spot where I had hit the driveway. There was a serious bruise on the side of my left shoulder. My chest hurt, and breathing wasn't entirely painless. But overall, I was okay. I was in better shape than Paulie, which is all that mattered. I thumbed my teeth up into my gums and held them there.
"Never felt better," I said.
"Your lip is all swollen."
"I'll live."
"We should celebrate."
I slid out of the car. "We should talk about getting you out of here," I said. She said nothing to that. The phone inside the gatehouse started ringing. It had an old-fashioned bell in it, low and slow and relaxing. It sounded faint and far away, muffled by the noise of the wind and the sea. It rang once, then twice. I walked around the Cadillac's hood and went inside and picked it up, said Paulie's name and waited a beat, and heard a voice I hadn't heard in 10 years.
"Did he show up yet?"
I paused.
10 minutes ago,"
I said. I kept my hand halfway over the mouthpiece and made my voice high and light.
"Is he dead yet?"
5 minutes ago."
"Okay. Stay ready. This is going to be a long day."
You got that right, I thought. Then the phone clicked off, and I put it down and stepped back outside.
"Who was it?"
Elizabeth asked. "Quinn," I said. The first time I heard Quinn's voice was 10 years previously, on a cassette tape. Cole had a telephone tap going. It was unauthorized, but back then military law was a lot more generous than civilian procedure. The cassette was a clear plastic thing that showed the little spools of tape inside. Cole had a player the size of a shoebox with her, and she clicked the cassette into it and pressed the button. My office filled with Quinn's voice. He was talking to an offshore bank, making financial arrangements. He sounded relaxed. He spoke clearly and slowly with the neutral, homogenized accent you get from a lifetime in the Army. He read out account numbers and gave passwords and issued instructions concerning a total of $500,000. He wanted most of it moved to the Bahamas.
"He mails the cash," Cole said, "to Grand Cayman first."
"Is that safe?" She nodded.
"Safe enough. The only risk would be postal workers stealing it. But the destination address is a P.O. box, and he sends it book rate, and nobody steals books out of the mail. So he gets away with it.
$500,000 is a lot of money.
It's a valuable weapon.
Is it? That valuable?
Don't you think so?
I shrugged. Seems like a lot to me. For a lawn dart?
She pointed at the tape player, pointed at Quinn's voice filling the air. Well, that's what they're paying, obviously. I mean, how else did he get $500,000? He didn't save it out of his salary, that's for sure.
When will you make your move?
Tomorrow. We'll have to. He's got the final blueprint. Gorowski says it's the key to the whole thing.
How will it go down?
Frasconi is dealing with the Syrian. He's going to mark the cash with a judge advocate watching. Then we'll all observe the exchange. We'll open the briefcase that Quinn gives to the Syrian immediately in front of the same judge. We'll document the contents, which will be the key blueprint. Then we'll go pick Quinn up. We'll arrest him and impound the briefcase that the Syrian gave to him. The judge can watch us open it later. We'll find the marked cash inside, and therefore we'll have a witnessed and documented transaction, and therefore Quinn will go down and he'll stay down.
Watertight, I said. Good work.
Thank you.
Will Frasconi be okay?
He'll have to be. I can't deal with the Syrian myself. Those guys are weird with women. They can't touch us, can't look at us. Sometimes they can't even talk to us. So Frasconi will have to do it.
Want me to hold his hand?
His part is all off stage. There's nothing much he can screw up.
I think I'll hold his hand anyway.
Thank you.
And he'll go with you to make the arrest? She said nothing. I can't send you one-on-one, you know that. She nodded. But I'll tell him you're the lead investigator. I'll make sure he understands it's your case.
Okay.
She pressed the stop button on her tape player. Quinn's voice died halfway through a word. The word was going to be dollars, as in 200,000, but it came out as doll. He sounded bright and happy and alert, like a guy at the top of his game, fully aware he was busy playing and winning. Cole ejected the cassette, slipped it into her pocket. Then she winked at me and walked out of my office.
"Who's Quinn?"
Elizabeth Beck asked me 10 years later. "Frank Xavier," I said. "He used to be called Quinn. His full name is Francis Xavier Quinn."
"You know him?"
"Why else would I be here?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm a guy who knew Frank Xavier back when he was called Francis Xavier Quinn.